Bob Bunting, he was my great uncle. So that, you know, a couple generations ago, and then my father, Don, and then Terrell and David, his brothers, and there's a few of us. And if you spend your time in the Northeast and in Tennessee specifically, you're going to hit a whole lot of them. So that's kind of neat. I'm really excited to have the chance to be here with you. I have been excited about this topic. I enjoy considering the word fellowship. I think it's an interesting word. I think Lee hit the nail on the head in that it's a Bible word that has very spiritual connotations to it. And it's an exciting word in the context of the Bible. It's also exciting in Christendom in general. People use it a lot, accurately and inaccurately. So it is a word that people are interested in. And so for that reason, I think it's an interesting topic. I also think that it touches on some of the greater blessings that we have in God. And so I'm excited to talk about that aspect of it. Tonight, to lead into it, the whole lesson series is basically, it's all from the New Testament, and so I wanted a good Old Testament lesson to talk about the idea. We're not going to talk about the word fellowship. We're going to look more at the idea of God building relationships. And so that relationship idea is a very common and prevalent idea in churches today. People want to have a relationship with God. Or maybe one step beyond that, sometimes we hear to have a personal relationship with God. And I think that that is a Bible idea. We don't see the word relationship used, but sons of God, heirs, brothers of Christ. So there is definitely the relationship concept in the Bible. And I want to kind of focus a little bit on that. In the Old Testament, there's a lot of God being married to his people. We see that in the New Testament also. So relationship is throughout the Bible. And we're going to look a little bit at that concept, but really what I have found is interesting is, rather than focusing on the word relationship, if we focus on the word fellowship with the idea of relationship, that we'll have a pretty good idea about what the Bible wants us to understand in New Testament fellowship, sharing and partnership with Christians and sharing and partnership with God. And I think that it'll help us to really appreciate what we have in God. And so that's what we're going to look at. I'm going to try to have handouts for you at the lessons. You do not have to take one if you're not interested. That does not hurt my feelings. I always say that if they were being handed out, I wouldn't probably want one. It would get in my way. I'd drop it and that sort of thing. So even I wouldn't necessarily want a copy, but I know that a lot of people like to have copies. You can read ahead and know where I'm going if you're interested. Also, I can't touch everything in my lesson. I don't have enough time. And I also, you don't have enough time to look at that. So there are going to be some things where I say, read this on your own time, and if you don't have the time to write it down, it'll be there in the handout, and you can look at that. If the screen is hard to read or something, you can let me know. I've got a few of these, and I don't mind changing this sort of stuff up. All right, so we're going to look at the idea of God's favor, and I want to start with one of the early instances of God showing favor, almost preference. We get a little bit uncomfortable sometimes when we look at God and his relationship with Cain and Abel. I want to look at this moment with Abel and then Enoch and Noah and just ask a few questions about this. In Genesis chapter 4, and then in chapter 5 we have Enoch, but in Genesis chapter 4 we have Abel. It's Cain and Abel, but really I want to just focus on Abel. We'll read through Cain to see the contrast. But in Genesis chapter 4, let's just read verses 3 through 7, just this smaller portion. In the course of time, Cain, Cain brought to the Lord an offering of the fruit of the ground, and Abel also brought of the firstborn of his flock and of their fat portions. And the Lord had regard for Abel and his offering, but for Cain and his offering he had no regard. So Cain was very angry, and his face fell. The Lord said to Cain, "Why are you angry, and why has your face fallen? If you do well, will you not be accepted, or will you not be lifted up?" I think is a better translation. "And if you do not do well, sin is crouching at the door. Its desire is for you, but you must rule over it. We don't know everything that was going on in this situation. And sometimes we say, well, how did Cain didn't know what to bring, and Abel knew what to bring. There's a whole lot of fruit of the ground offerings in the book of Exodus and Leviticus and Deuteronomy. So I don't think it was the objects necessarily that was the problem. We're going to look in the New Testament where there's a key description and a distinction about how faith was a big idea. We do see that Abel brought of the firstborn and of the fat portions, and it doesn't mention that Cain brought the firstborn tomato or the fat portion tomato. Maybe there is something there, but this story is just saying God had regard for the way Abel or what Abel was bringing, and he didn't have regard for it with Cain. But that is not to say that God hated Cain, because what did God do? Cain got upset. God talked to him. We don't know if God had any conversations with Abel. But how many times have you been angry and on the verge of sin, and God said, "Whoa, Dan, why has your countenance fallen? If you do well, will you not be lifted up?" And so Cain was, he had a lot of opportunity there. But God had favor for what Abel did and what Abel brought. If you turn a page or so over into chapter 5, chapter 5 is one of those chapters of just all the unpronounceable names and about how they were born and they had kids and they died. They were born, they had kids and they died. They were born, they had kids and they died. If you have paragraph form, you can find all the dying. In verse 5, and he died. Verse 8, and he died. Verse 11, and he died. Verse 14, and he died. And verse 17, and he died. And verse 20, and he died. Verse 21, when Enoch had lived 65 years, he fathered Methuselah. Enoch walked with God after he fathered Methuselah 300 years and had other sons and daughters. Thus all the days of Enoch were 365 years. Enoch walked with God, and he was not, for God took him. Verse 27, and he died. Verse 31, and he died. Chapter 6, and then everybody dies. So why does it list, and he died? We know that they always die, and if you look at the other genealogies, it doesn't mention, and he died, and he died, and he died. I think it mentions that all these people died to point out Enoch didn't. Enoch walked with God. He was with God. He was pleased with God, or God was pleased with him. There was some sort of relationship that they had. That's pretty neat. And we don't really know what that meant. How many prayers every day did he do? How many sacrifices? It just says that he walked with God. And it's such a curious and exciting thing to consider. But this guy had the opportunity to walk with God, and he did. He was there with God. And God took him. So that's neat. And that's exciting. And then in chapter 6, when man began to multiply on the face of the land and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw the daughters of man were attractive, and they took as their wives, any they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit shall not abide in man forever, for he is flesh. His days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of man, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown. The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." Have you ever thought about that? That's pretty extreme. Every intention of the heart, of the thoughts of his heart, was only evil continually. How many bad people do you know love their mama? This is beyond that, right? Verse 6, and the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and it grieved him to his heart. Think about the relationships maybe that he was wanting to have with people, and this is what he has instead. So, God was sorry. God was grieved because of this loss. And so the Lord said, "I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, man and animals and creeping things and birds of the heavens, for I am sorry that I made them." But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. In the Old Testament, and in Genesis in particular, we don't have a lot of details, but we do have enough information to let us realize there was a lot going on. God was giving out information. They knew to bring sacrifices, even though we might not have that recorded in the book of Genesis. They knew things. And God was building relationships with people. Apparently, he could talk to Cain, and Cain answered, seemingly as if this might have happened before. And Enoch walked with God, and Noah knew enough to find favor in God's eyes. But even with these efforts that we have at least hints of from God, the whole world chose otherwise. So there are people in God's favor out there, we see in the Bible, but it's this kind of rare moment, it's this glimpse in something good in the midst of, in chapter 6, a world of horror. Look at Hebrews chapter 11, and then there's also reference in 1 John 3. That can be one of your homework assignments to look at if you want. There's another reference there to Cain. And it really talks more about why Cain reacted the way he did at his brother rather than dealing with the sacrifice and whether or not it had favor with God. But it does talk about how Abel's deeds were righteous and Cain's weren't. But in Hebrews 11, we have Abel and we have Enoch. And in verse 7, also Noah. I need to just change this and do this whole paragraph. We'll start in Hebrews 11, verse 4. By faith, Abel offered to God a more acceptable sacrifice than Cain, through which he was commended as righteous, God commending him by accepting his gifts, and through his faith, though he died, he still speaks. By faith, Enoch was taken up so that he should not see death, and he was not found because God had taken him. Now, before he was taken, he was commended as having pleased God. And without faith, it is impossible to please him. For whoever would draw near to God must believe that he exists and that he rewards those who seek him. By faith, Noah, being warned by God concerning events not as yet unseen, in reverent fear, constructed an ark for the saving of his household. By this he condemned the world and became an heir of the righteousness that comes by faith. This lesson is not going to be about faith. Of course, the lesson of chapter 11 is. I'm trying to focus in on how there were some people who had this favor and this relationship with God, and God was reaching out to them, and they were reaching up to him in faith, in reverent fear, it mentions there with Noah. And so these things were happening. And if you look at 2 Peter, should be only a few pages away, 2 Peter chapter 2, another reference to Noah, looking at verses 4, I don't think I'll read all the way through 10. In this section, Peter, the point of chapter 2 is he's telling us there are false teachers out there, and they're nasty. This is one of the most ugly chapters in the Bible. It just sounds ugly. And it's describing sinners as ugly. And in this paragraph, 4 through 10, he's letting us know, look, God knows how to punish those ugly people. He gives a few examples. Verse 4, for if God did not spare angels when they sinned, but cast them into Tartarus or hell, and committed them to chains of gloomy darkness to be kept until the judgment, if he did not spare the ancient world, but preserved Noah, a herald of righteousness, with seven others when he brought a flood upon the world of the ungodly, and then Sodom and Gomorrah, and God saved Lot. He's using these different examples of how there were these people who turned themselves against God. What did God do? He chained up the angels. He flooded a planet. He burned two cities. God knows how to deal with the people that are not in a relationship with him. And at the same time, God can save those people with whom he does have this relationship, in this story of Noah and Lot, he can save them out of it. But the idea is to see that God is, he's building these things up. This would have been an encouraging message, I think, when the Israelites received the book of Genesis, wandering around in the wilderness. That's when Moses was writing these things down. So probably he was sending out the message and telling them God does take care of some. He has relationships with some. And that would be something that would be very big for them and important for them when we see how God was relating to his people in the books of Exodus. And we'll take a little moment to look at Leviticus also. But in Exodus, God makes a marked change. There is relationship and there are things going on in the book of Genesis, but in Exodus, God just pulls out all the stops. And he does some amazing things. Miracles in the Bible are focused around the time of Jesus and his apostles. You'll find miracles with Elijah and Elisha. And you'll find a bunch of miracles with Moses in this time period. There are other miracles in the Bible, but really the big piles of miracles is the Exodus time, the whole wandering in the wilderness time, Elijah and Elisha, and Jesus and the apostles. This is one of the big moments where God reaches out to show the world who he is and who his people is. And in chapter 3, God's talking to Moses in the burning bush. Moses had seen this bush on fire, but not getting consumed by the fire up on this mountain. He goes up there. God begins to talk. And in verse 7, the Lord said, I have surely seen the affliction of my people who are in Egypt and have heard their cry because of their taskmasters. I know their suffering, and I have come down to deliver them out of the hand of the Egyptians and to bring them up out of the land to a good and broad land, a land flowing with milk and honey, to the place of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, the Jebusites. And now, behold, the cry of the people of Israel has come to me, and I have also seen the oppression with which the Egyptians oppressed them. Come, I will send you to Pharaoh, that you may bring my people, the children of Israel, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the children of Israel out of Egypt? He said, but I will be with you, and this shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. Think about what has been going on in the Bible, or even just think about the world that you live in, and God saying the words, I have seen the affliction of my people, I have heard their cry. The creator of the universe, the king of everything, heard people. Somehow they mattered enough to be heard. Somehow they mattered enough to be seen. They were just slaves. Slaves who were being told to kill their kids. Slaves who were being forced to do things that were sins and wrong. And they were trying to fight back and not sin while still slaves and stuck in a rotten situation. God says, I see them. Now think about God seeing you. This is a big deal. God says, I see them, I have heard them, I'm going to act, I'm going to come down and do things. Moses says, who am I? God says the same thing to him, but I will be with you. I will be with you. And then he gives Moses a sign. Now we know that he gives Moses a lot of signs and miracles to prove things, but this sign is kind of interesting. This shall be the sign for you that I have sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. That's not a sign that will help convince them to leave. Because that sign will only be seen once they've already left. You're going to be with me here on the mountain someday, and that's going to prove this conversation. That's a lot of faith to get back to that mountain. Now, Moses did get some other signs for the benefit of others. I think that this sign was for the benefit of Moses. In chapter 19, they're back on that mountain. And think about all the things that God did in between there to get them to that mountain. Now, the reason I'm going to not be able to read all the different sections and passages in my lesson is because I want to read all of chapter 19. So you don't have to take a deep breath for this, but I'm going to. Let's read through 19 and get the image of God didn't just see his people. He came and made a personal visit to them. So, Exodus chapter 19. On the third new moon after the people of Israel had gone out of the land of Egypt, on that day they came into the wilderness of Sinai. They set out from Rephidim and came into the wilderness of Sinai, and they encamped in the wilderness. There Israel encamped before the mountain, while Moses went up to God. The Lord called to him out of the mountain, saying, thus you shall say to the house of Jacob, tell the people of Israel, you yourselves have seen what I did to the Egyptians, and how I bore you on eagle's wings and brought you to myself. Now therefore, if you will indeed obey my voice and keep my covenant, you shall be my treasured possession among all peoples, for all the earth is mine. And you shall be to me a kingdom of priests and a holy nation. These are the words that you shall speak to the people of Israel. So Moses came and called the elders of the people and set before them all these words that the Lord had commanded him. And the people answered together and said, "All that the Lord has spoken, we will do." I like to point out that all the commands really come after that. That's a statement of faith also. And a lot of times, if we want to make a commitment to God, before we even know what all the rules are, we need to trust that the rules will be good enough. We can make a commitment like this too. Moses reported all the words of the people to the Lord. And the Lord said to Moses, "Behold, I am coming to you in a thick cloud, that the people may hear when I speak to you and may also believe you forever." When Moses told the words of the people to the Lord said to Moses, "Go to the people and consecrate them today and tomorrow, and let them wash their garments and be ready for the third day. For on the third day, the Lord will come down on Mount Sinai in sight of all the people. And you should set limits for the people all around, saying, 'Take care not to go up into the mountain or touch the edge of it. Whoever touches the mountain shall be put to death. No hand shall touch him, but he shall be stoned or shot. Whether beast or man, he shall not live. When the trumpet sounds a long blast, they shall come up to the mountain.'" So Moses went down from the mountain to the people and consecrated the people, and they washed their garments. And he said to the people, "Be ready for the third day, and do not go near a woman." And on the morning of the third day, there were thunders and lightnings, and a thick cloud on the mountain, and a very loud trumpet blast, so that all the people in the camp trembled. Then Moses brought the people out of the camp to meet God, and they took their stand on the foot of the mountain. Now Mount Sinai was wrapped in smoke, because the Lord had descended on it in fire. The smoke of it went up like the smoke of a kiln, and the whole mountain trembled greatly. And as the sound of the trumpet grew louder and louder, Moses spoke, and God answered him in thunder. The Lord came down on Mount Sinai to the top of the mountain, and the Lord called Moses to the top of the mountain, and Moses went up. And the Lord said to Moses, "Go down and warn the people, lest they break through to the Lord to look, and many of them perish. Also let the priests who come near to the Lord consecrate themselves, lest the Lord break out against them." And Moses said to the Lord, "The people cannot come up to Mount Sinai, for you yourself warned us, saying, 'Set limits around the mountain and consecrate it.' And the Lord said to him, 'Go down and come up, bringing Aaron with you, but do not let the priests and the people break through to come up to the Lord, lest he break out against them.' So Moses went down to the people and told them." And he jumped into chapter 20, verse 18, after the Ten Commandments. "Now when all the people saw the thunder and flashes of lightning and the sound of the trumpet and the mountain smoking, the people were afraid and trembled. And they stood far off and said to Moses, 'You speak to us and we will listen, but do not let God speak to us, lest we die.' Moses said to the people, 'Do not fear, for God has come to test you, that the fear of him may be before you, that you may not sin.' The people stood far off while Moses drew near to the thick darkness where God was." When God shows up, it's a big deal. Which to me makes him be someone who comes in this manner in chapter 19, the fact that he was listening to anybody in chapter 3. God is making this big effort to be with the people. He's even kind enough to say, "Don't come to the mountain or you'll die." They know better than to do that just when he starts talking. And it says he spoke with thunder. I'm wondering if they could even understand any word. I don't know. This is the way that God is. In chapter 25, we're going to look at a few passages going through Exodus. But think about all the different efforts God makes to be with this people. Now, he does say things like, "You need to wash your clothes, you need to wash up, you need to consecrate yourselves." That basically means you need to get yourself ready. So they weren't just sitting lazily on a couch. They had to get themselves ready, but it's always God making this big effort. And in verse 17, he says, "You shall make a mercy seat of pure gold, And then he starts describing that the two cubits this and the length, and you're going to hammer the cherubim out of gold, and you can start looking through all these great things about it. Verse 20, the cherubim shall spread out their wings above, overshadowing the mercy seat with their wings. This is literally going to be a seat of mercy. You know, sometimes we say mercy seat, mercy seat, mercy seat, and it becomes one word in my mind. And it's two words. It's a seat of mercy, and it's where God sits. And the sitting place, this seat, is going to be a lid over this ark. Verse 21, you shall put the mercy seat on top of the ark, and in the ark you shall put the testimony that I shall give you. There I will meet with you. And from above the mercy seat, from between the two cherubim that are on the ark of the testimony, I will speak with you about all that I will give you in commandment for the people of Israel. God says, make a chair for me to come and sit with you. This is exciting stuff. Now, they had to make the chair. But God is saying, if you do this, I will sit here. That's access. That's exciting. It's interesting to think about that. And a few chapters over in chapter 29, 38, talking about a very specific offering here. The end of chapter 29 and verse 38. Now this is what you shall offer on the altar. Two lambs of a year old day by day regularly. One lamb you shall offer in the morning, and the other lamb you shall offer at twilight. And with the first lamb, a tenth seah of fine flour mingled with the fourth of a hin of beaten oil and a fourth of a hin of wine for a drink offering. The other lamb you shall offer at twilight and shall offer it with grain offering and its drink offering as in the morning for a pleasing aroma. A food offering to the Lord. It shall be a regular burnt offering throughout your generations at the entrance of the tent of meeting before the Lord, where I will meet with you, to speak with you there. There I will meet with the people of Israel, and it shall be sanctified by my glory. I will consecrate the tent of meeting and the altar. Aaron also and his sons I will consecrate to serve me as priests. I will dwell among the people of Israel and will be their God. And they shall know that I am the Lord, their God, who brought them out of the land of Egypt, that I might dwell among them. I am the Lord, their God. And you might have another translation there for dwell. God's given them all these instructions. But it's not like if you do this magic trick with two sheep every day, God will magically appear. If you rub the lamp, the genie comes out. God is saying, this is what you need to do. I will come. He's willing to dwell with them, to talk to them. And for a lot of the time when they're wandering through the wilderness, that pillar of fire and that cloud, he was very physically there in a sense. They could look and see something and it would be God. Whether he was in the cloud and fire, or if it was a symbol. And that was an exciting thing for God's people. Leviticus has a few continuations of this. Try to look at this a little bit quickly. Very quickly. In chapter 9, the end of chapter 9, this is the time when really the whole tabernacle and the priests, it's all being, it's just set up. This is when it's happening. It's kicked off. These great things are happening. And in verse 23, Moses and Aaron went into the tent of meeting and there came out. And when they came out, they blessed the people. And the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people. And fire came out from the Lord and consumed the burnt offering. And then what happened in chapter 10? Apparently, God showing up doesn't mean that everyone's just, hey, let's do everything God says. Nadab and Abihu kind of make that plain. But God doesn't give up. He even though there's this moment of people refusing to glorify God, God stays with this people. And in chapter 26, there's again this image of God walking among his people. And he promises that if you continue to do things, I will walk among you. Which is that image that we have with Enoch. Walking with God. And so God and his people, God made a lot of efforts to have a people and to be there with them. And then the people get to the point, they finally get rich enough, right? David, he has this feeling in 2 Samuel 7, we won't turn there, but he says, look, I've got a really nice house, and God's living in a tent. Why am I living in something nice when God isn't living in something nice? I should build him a nice house. And Nathan said, sure, go do that. Sounds like a good idea. God says, no. But God does say to David, I will make you a house, which is an interesting term. But God also then says that your son, and so we see that in Solomon, that Solomon is going to build a house for God. I do want to look a little bit here at 1 Kings 6 and 8, just to see how God showed up on the mountain, and then he showed up at this tabernacle there in Leviticus chapter 9, and these different moments. He's willing to sit on that seat and speak and be there with the people. In chapter 6, verses 11 through 13, now the word of the Lord came to Solomon, concerning this house that you are building, if you walk in my statutes and obey my rules and keep all my commandments and walk in them, I will establish my word with you, which I spoke to David your father, and I will dwell among the children of Israel and will not forsake my people Israel. If you do these things, I will live with you, is what God is saying. And in this middle portion of chapter 8, they're dedicating in a very similar scene to when Moses and Aaron, they had gone into the tabernacle and they came out and the glory of the Lord appeared. Look at chapter 8, verse 10. When the priests came out of the holy place, a cloud filled the house of the Lord so that the priests could not stand to minister because of the cloud before the glory of the Lord filled the house of the Lord. I think that this is a very funny moment. God shows up, and there's so much God there, they can't minister the way God wants them to minister. He came, and they have to come out. Now, that's interesting. Are they sinning because they're not ministering like they ought? No, there's something superseding that. And I'm sure that they did everything they could to get to be back there. But God came very visibly, very physical as a cloud can be. But even later on in the chapter, when Solomon starts to pray, he has an interesting point about God living in a house like this. Verse 27, but will God indeed dwell on earth? Even though God showed up physically, kind of, there's this point of, this can't hold God. When God shows up, we can't even do what we're supposed to do with it. But one thing he does say that I think encourages me, in verse 28, have regard to the prayer of your servant and to his plea, O Lord my God, listening to the cry and to the prayer that your servant prays before you this day, that your eyes may be open night and day toward this house, the place of which you have said, my name shall be there, and that you listen to the prayer that your servant offers toward this place, and listen to the plea of your servant and of your people, Israel, when they pray toward this place, and listen in heaven, your dwelling place, and when you hear, forgive. He says, are you even going to live here? You're God. But when I am praying here right now, he says, and when I pray in the future, he says, and when your people pray, it's almost like as they direct themselves at this house, listen. He says, God, you are saying you are living here, and we are going to come to you and pray here. Listen to us. And he does. The rest of this prayer is all about that. All the different ramifications of it. If we sin, and we come and pray, or if we sin this way, and we come and pray. And it's really clear that whether or not God is 100% shoving his entity within this building or not, this is a place of where they can come to God. We can pray anywhere, but they would have this place, this house that they built for God, a house that ended up being a little inhospitable. It just wasn't a good place for God to live eventually. Think of all the things that happened there. and the kings who wanted to do their own sacrifices there. And the mess that happens. Let's go to Ezekiel 10. This is one of those that it's so cool, the image that we have here. Your homework assignment is to read 9, 10, and 11. There will not be a quiz. But you need to read 9 and 10 and 11 for the tiny parts that I'm pulling out to click. Ezekiel is a prophet that just has the wildest visions. And in chapter 9, God plucks him up and takes him to the temple in this vision. And there's a hole. He says, open up that hole, dig through, get inside the temple. And what do you see? I don't think that is in chapter 9. That's another vision. But there's this vision where he sees horrible things going on in the temple. In chapter 9 is this judgment scene where this messenger has to go out and mark the people in Jerusalem who are sad about sin. And he's going to put this mark on their heads. And whoever doesn't have that mark on their heads by the end of the chapter, verse 7, then he said to them, defile the house and fill the courts with the slain. Go out. So they went out and struck in the city. And while they were striking, I was left alone. And I fell on my face and cried, oh, Lord God, will you destroy all the remnant of Israel and the outpouring of your wrath on Jerusalem? And then he said to me, the guilt of the house of Israel and Judah is exceedingly great. The land is full of blood and the city full of injustice. For they say, the Lord has forsaken the land. The Lord does not see. Which would fly right in the face of what's happening here. God is seeing. It would fly right in the face of all the prayers of God. Be at this temple. Be at this house. Well, in chapter 10, 18 and 19, and then in chapter 11, verse 18, if you read Ezekiel 1, there's the weird vision of the wheel. Ezekiel saw the wheel and the wheel within the wheel, and it seems to be describing essentially this chariot or this car that with a throne that God sits on. So have that in mind. Verse 18, then the glory of the Lord went out from the threshold of the house and stood over the cherubim. And the cherubim lifted up on their wings and mounted up from the earth before my eyes. And they went out with the wheels beside them. And they stood at the entrance of the east gate of the house of the Lord. And the glory of the God of Israel was over them. What did they do? God was in the temple in this vision. And he gets out and he gets in his chariot. And it starts getting up and going. And at the end of chapter 11, verse 22, then the cherubim lifted up their wings with the wheels beside them, and the glory of the Lord, a God of Israel, was over them, and the glory of the Lord went up from the midst of the city and stood on the mountain that is on the east side of the city. And the Spirit lifted me up and brought me in the vision by the Spirit of God into Chaldea, into the exiles. And the vision that I had seen went up from me, and I told all the exiles all the things that the Lord had shown me. What did God do? He left his house. He got in his car and he drove away. All those times where God came to his people and he goes away there. I enjoy the Psalms. And the Psalms do a great job at summing up lots of things. They do a better job than me. And starting at Psalm 73, all through the 70s and into the 80s, Asaph is writing. And he is writing after a time when God's people were beat up because they were horrible. I have a hard time placing Asaph. I can't remember exactly where he is. But as you start to read through, you can see how his psalms are, God, we did horrible things. And you've punished us. How long are you going to keep this up? And also some psalms of, God, we trust in you. You are our only hope. And then some psalms, God, we are getting beat up. Where are you? And so this section of the Psalms, I think, is a very powerful way of looking at this kind of idea that we've been scanning through in the Old Testament. 78? I'm clearly not reading Psalm 78. It's massive. It is an epic. I mean, it is one of those 2.5, 3.5 hour movies that you wonder how you're going to make through. But it's telling a whole story. And you start look, just find a little section, start reading through, and you did this for them, God, and you did this for them, and they started doing these things. But then, they sinned, and you punished them, but then you did this for them, God, and then you did these things, and they were with you, but then, they sinned. Over and over and over again, this is what it is about. It closes 70, well, 67 really through 72, but it closes with this idea of he's built a sanctuary. Of course, we read in Ezekiel what happened to that sanctuary. He chose David and David's children. What happened to all those kings eventually? 79 continues that desperation. Look at verse 5. How long, O Lord? Will you be angry forever? Will your jealousy burn like fire? Pour out your anger on the nations that do not know you, and on the kingdoms that do not call upon your name. For they have devoured Jacob and laid waste his habitation. Think about that. How long are you going to allow this to be, God? Destroy these nations who don't know you, who don't call on your name, because they've devoured your people and laid waste his habitation. I think that his there is not referring back to God, it's probably referring back to Jacob, but it kind of made me think about how God made a habitation in the people in that temple there. And so Asaph is pleading with God, make this right again. We've been punished, but please bring us back. Prophecies in Jeremiah, prophecies in Isaiah, we are going to skip over these. But about how God is just, he's going to do these things to get the people back. In Jeremiah 31, which is quoted in Hebrews, the idea of, I'm going to make a new covenant with them. It's going to be amazing again. Things are going to be great. You're not going to have to teach each other know God, because you're all going to know me. That's a pretty great relationship. And in Isaiah, come out from among them. Something again quoted in 2 Corinthians chapter 6. We're going to be looking at that as the weekend progresses. But the idea of come out from among them that don't know God and be with God. Again, that idea of reestablishing this relationship. The fact that God was willing to do all these things in the first place, and then they ruined it. But that he's willing to try again. I say try. The next try is Jesus. That's not trying. That's succeeding. Whether or not many go to him. They shall call his name Emmanuel, which means God with us. I mean, it was pretty exciting when God showed up on the mountain. It was pretty exciting when God showed up at the mercy seat or in the tabernacle or in the temple. But then he actually physically showed up and very emotionally cared for people, or even emotionally was upset about people. And he did everything right and everything in a perfect way. God showed up. And I didn't get to see him. That's okay. I know he came. And I can read a whole lot of stuff about him and what he was like. And I can learn really everything I need to know about him in that sense. Let's look at Hebrews. We're going to be closing with Hebrews. Hebrews chapter 9. Hebrews is encouraging Christians to say, look guys, don't go back. Don't go back. Don't go backwards. Don't go back into old ideas or habits. The particular go back here would be the Jewish Christians, don't go back to Judaism. Being a Christian was getting pretty stressful and more difficult day by day. And those Jewish Christians, though they were probably not great citizens in the Roman Empire when they were Jews, being Christians was, you know, definitely a step down when the prospect of being thrown to the lions and burned at the stake was what was coming. So maybe they're being intimidated about those sorts of things. In chapter 9, the point, the whole book, but then especially in chapter 9, the point is to say, God did some pretty great things to build in a relationship and establish a connection with the people, but do you know what God has done now? And so we reread through the tabernacle. Chapter 9, verses 1 through 10. Think about who went into God's house. Now, even the first covenant had regulations for worship and an earthly place of holiness. For a tent was prepared, the first section in which were the lampstand and the table and the bread of the presence. It was called the holy place. Behind the second curtain was the second section called the most holy place, having the golden altar of incense and the ark of the covenant covered on all sides with gold, in which was a golden urn holding the manna and Aaron's staff that budded and the tablets of the covenant. Above it were the cherubim of glory overshadowing the mercy seat. Of these things we cannot now speak in detail. He was running out of time in his lesson too. Verse 6, these preparations having thus been made, the priests go regularly into the first section, performing their ritual duties. But into the second section, only the high priest goes, and he but once a year, and not without taking blood, which he offers for himself and for the unintentional sins of the people. By this, the Holy Spirit indicates that the way into the holy places is not yet opened, as long as the first section is still standing, which is symbolic for the present age. According to this arrangement, gifts and sacrifices are offered that cannot perfect the conscience of the worshiper, but only deal with food and drink and various washings, regulations for the body imposed until the time of Reformation. Who could go in? The priests could go into that holy place. But that's not everybody. That's no women. And that's not foreigners. And it's a very select few of the Jewish men who weren't foreigners, right? But then into the next spot, even less. And less often. And when he does go, it's with tons of preparation because of his own dirtiness. And so there's that idea in verse 8. By this, the Holy Spirit indicates that the way into the holy places is not yet opened as long as the first section is still standing. God says this is the holy place. But the reality is, it's not a place you can go to. Oh. That's kind of sad. There's something in the way. They just weren't allowed to go. And then, verses 11 through 15. But when Christ appeared as the high priest of the good things that have come, then through the greater and more perfect tent, not made with hands, that is not of this creation, he entered once for all into the holy places, not by means of blood of goats or calves, but by means of his own blood, thus securing an eternal redemption. For if the blood of goats and bulls and the sprinkling of defiled persons with the ashes of a heifer sanctify for the purification of flesh, how much more will the blood of Christ, who through the eternal Spirit offered himself without blemish to God, purify our conscience from dead works to serve the living God? Therefore, he is the mediator of a new covenant, so that those who are called may receive the promised eternal inheritance, since a death has occurred that redeems them from the transgressions committed under the first covenant. Christ just blew it all out of the water. He ripped the veil. Literally. And all he had to do that was just die, and the thing ripped in half. Not to diminish his death. But it's not like he stormed into the temple and did it. That would have been a very physical activity. He died and came back from the dead. And when he died, that veil ripped. His physical death had spiritual results and physical, which is pretty interesting. All of those great efforts that God had been making with his people so that he could be with them and live there and sit on a seat and walk among them and dwell with them, and they ruined it. And he had them rebuild another temple. Interestingly enough, we don't have that big cloud showing up anymore. But he wanted them to build a temple, and they did it. And then Jesus dies, and it rips. But now, that middle thing is out of the way. And people can get to God. Verse 23. Thus it was necessary for the copies of the heavenly things to be purified with these rites, but the heavenly things themselves with better sacrifices than these earthly ones. For Christ has entered not into holy places made with hands, which are copies of the true things, but into heaven itself, now to appear in the presence of God on our behalf. Nor was it to offer himself repeatedly, as the high priest enters the holy place every year with the blood not his own, for then he would have to suffer repeatedly since the foundation of the world. But as it is, he has appeared once for all at the end of the ages to put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And just as it is appointed for man to die once, and after that comes judgment, so Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time to deal with sin, not to deal with sin, but to save those who are eagerly waiting for him. He showed up to deal with sin. If all of this effort, and God having this relationship, and setting these things up, wash yourselves before I show up, or you need to consecrate yourselves before the tabernacle and wash yourself in the sacrifice before you do these things where God is going to be. Why were they dirty and why did they not have a relationship with God? Well, we didn't read Genesis chapter 3, did we? But it looks like they were walking around with God in the garden in the cool of the day before sin. And when God showed up for his evening stroll, they were ashamed and hiding. That's what happened to all of these great relationships that God had, or could have had. And so that's why he's doing all of these otherworldly efforts to have relationships and have this fellowship, this unity again with people. And he finally has these examples and these images in this Old Testament, this tabernacle and the mountain that he showed up on with thunder and the temple that he showed up at in a cloud. Finally, he sends Jesus to do it the right way. Those were images to help us understand the right way even more clearly. And he says in verse 28, let's read it again. So Christ, having been offered once to bear the sins of many, will appear a second time, not to deal with sin, but to save those who are eagerly waiting for him. When Jesus showed up, he fixed the problem of the broken relationships, and it was sin. What breaks our fellowship with God? Sin. And he already fixed it. And so, since Christ came, Christians can have this ultimate and perfect relationship with God, where we don't need to say, oh, I wish I knew God more, and I wish God knew me more. Now we might, okay, that's not to say, don't read your Bible. We need to learn about God more. But it's like this is as good as it gets. This is great. Kind of feels weird on this earth. I think it's going to be a little bit better in heaven. But this is the relationship because we have it together. Because when Jesus shows up again, he's not going to take care of our problems because those have been taken care of. He's just going to save us. Right? That does imply that there is a problem. We're on this globe and we need saving from this place. It's a horrible place. Springtime's great. But then the mayflies come, right? We have friends. And then sorrows come. We need saving from this place. We'll close by looking at Hebrews 12. We looked at Mount Sinai earlier. Let's think about Mount Zion. Oh, I took out, I had the verses that I was going to read there. We're going to start in verse 18. For you have not come to what may be touched, a blazing fire and darkness and gloom and a tempest, the sound of a trumpet and a voice whose words made the hearers beg that no further messages be spoken to them, for they could not endure the order that was given, if even a beast touches the mountain, it shall be stoned. Indeed, so terrifying was the sight that Moses said, I tremble with fear. What mountain is he talking about? He's talking about Mount Sinai. I don't know. I keep going back and looking in Exodus 19 for the moment that Moses says, I tremble with fear. He was putting on a brave face with people. Oh, don't fear, he says. God's testing you to see that you fear him, but don't fear. That's an interesting pairing that God wants us to have. That's not the mountain we've come to. We have not come to a mountain of that kind of terror fear, that maybe the respectful fear that we should have, the respectful fear that Noah used in faith to build the ark. Verse 23, but you have come to Mount Zion and to the city of the living God, the heavenly Jerusalem, and to innumerable angels in festal gathering, and to the assembly of the firstborn who are enrolled in heaven, and to God, the judge of all, and to the spirits of the righteous made perfect, and to Jesus, the mediator of a better covenant, and to the sprinkled blood that speaks better word than the blood of Abel. We've come to a lot of stuff. It's hard for me to read 22 through 24 and not have the image in my mind of heaven. But he's not saying you will come to. You have come to. And when we look in the book of Revelation, we have these images of the way the saving and this thing that we're looking forward to, it's pretty similar. I think what the author of Hebrews is trying to tell us, whatever we are going to have in heaven, the spiritual perfection and completeness, he wants us to know that we have access to that today. We have come to God. We are on his mountain, whether we're in a valley or in a river, we are on his mountain. We are in fellowship with God, if we're in favor with him. We are with the angels, just singing as loudly as they can, if we are walking with God. We are with Jesus, the mediator of a better covenant, if we submit to what he did for us. Not like we got to do very much, but we have to submit. We have to obey. We have to say, dear God, save me, a sinner. And when we do that, we are with God. And it's exciting. And it's as exciting as it was when God showed favor for Abel and not for Cain. It's even better for us today. And as exciting as it was when he told Noah to build an ark, or when he sent the rains, or when he was talking in a burning bush, or on the mountain, or any other number of times when he spoke to people and showed up and burned things so that they believe in him, or he'd make things wet, or he'd make things not wet, and he'd change shadows, and he'd change the sky, it's better. And we have to get it into our heads that that is what it means to have a relationship with God. A personal relationship with God is more than, oh, I love God and I know God loves me. That's definitely a part of it. But when we understand the gravity behind what it means, what God's love means, and what he's demanding our love to be like, there's going to be a lot of work and effort and desire and care and excitement. It's not going to be, all right, I got to show up at church again. It's going to be, this is another time to be with my fellow saints, which is what he was talking about earlier in chapter 12. Or is it chapter 10? I keep getting this too mixed up. There's so much involved in having this fellowship together with God. And I think that the Old Testament does a good job at getting me excited about it. And I'm excited to continue looking at the topic of fellowship. Tomorrow night, Lord willing, we're going to define it and describe it. And so we're going to look at, what is a Greek word, as if you know Greek, now you can do magic tricks and things. It's not really anything super impressive. We all have access to it pretty easily with books, and you can borrow books, or if you have the internet, you can get all this information online. A lot of mine actually copy-pasted from the internet. But the idea is, let's define the word and describe it as it's used in a bunch of different ways in the New Testament. However, when you do definitions, do you ever just go, oh man, I'm feeling really spiritual right now. I'm getting excited because I'm looking at definitions. I don't. Remember what fellowship is all about, this relationship concept. Tomorrow night's lesson, I think, is interesting, and but it's all data, and it can get tedious. But Let's keep in mind what this data is supposed to help us appreciate. And if we see sometimes the word is used this way in the world and it's not the right way in the Bible, we can say, well, is it the right direction or is it not the right direction? We'll be able to make a good decision about it. But the whole time the point is relationship with God, God's effort to have fellowship with us, and our partnership with Him. Jesus died for us. Lessons on fellowship, and I've been doing a few of these lessons already, they don't lend themselves to invitation-style lessons always. But this lesson tonight, I was trying to sum up the Bible in a shorter amount of time than I did. God has done everything possible for us to be with Him. He doesn't flick us, though. And He doesn't change our brains to make us do things. Because He wants partnership. He wants fellowship. And so you can have that. I don't know all of you very well, and I don't know what your needs are. And if you have not known God, if you have not submitted to Christ's offer to save you, you absolutely need to do it. Or if you have submitted to it, but you've been like the Israelites, like I have been at times, you said, you know, I'll pray about it tomorrow. That's not a relationship with God. That sort of prayer isn't heard. You need to make sure that you are in fellowship with God again. I don't know all of you personally and very well, but I know well enough that there's a lot of people here who want to talk to you if you have needs. And if you have a good friend here that you know better than me, by all means, talk to your close friends and get help. If you need to know about what you need to do to be saved and to learn about baptism, ask questions. We want to help you. I want to help you, and I know everyone else wants to help you here. By all means, do what you can to be in fellowship with God, because God is knocking at the door. He's asking for you to come to Him. Thank you for your time this evening, and God bless you. And I'm excited to continue our studies together.